This is Talk Is Cheap on KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peace Works Independent Community Radio. All right, today I have some highlights from this year's 2024 Eugene Environmental Film Festival that I did originally as news pieces. And I just have a little commentary here. I just want to say that I knew that the healthcare shooter was going to only have two names because shooters of people on the left have three names, unless you're Sirhan. I'm looking right now for, as regards to Syria, I'm looking for information on Rojava, which is an anarchist stronghold in Syria. And please research this stuff yourself. I'm not an expert on Syria, but in what little research I've done on Rojava, I found that as bad as he was, Assad was keeping peace in an area with a bunch of multiple factions that are always fighting one another. And I've been paying attention to Turkey and Erdogan, and because of the interest rates that, as bad as he is, he kept the interest rates down instead of raising them during the Syrian refugee crisis when the economy collapsed in Syria, in Turkey, because of the Syrian refugee crisis. He still kept the interest rates down even with pressure from the dollar. So those are just some little things. And what I think is going to happen is what John Mearsheimer is saying is going to happen, and others, because there's always a third way of looking at things. What they're saying is that this is going to be a quagmire in Syria, and Trump is not going to be able to keep us out of war. And let's face it, last time he was president, he dropped the mother of all bombs in Syria. So hopefully he won't drop the destroyer of all worlds bomb this time. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Support independent media. So yeah, look up Rojava on YouTube. And this is basically the corporate... the U.S. foreign economic policy, the U.S. corporate foreign economic policy is going to make sure that things are unstable unless they can extract things cheaply.
There's a scourge threatening the airwaves right now. I'm talking about that earworm wrangler and rhyme criminal, Justin Bieber. I don't care if he gets his Coke from Colombia, his product from Pennsylvania, he should be arrested just for rhyming holy with hold me. His music is vapid, his lyrics are trite. Now don't kill Justin Bieber. Cutting his hair will only slow him down. If you want to stop Justin Bieber and others like him, go to kepw.org and become a sustaining member, or just send a couple of dollars. We're all volunteers, so you get more bang for your buck. Go to kepw.org and stop inane music today.
Brought to you by Crazy Larry MD's Procedure Emporium, where they're crazy for your health care. Hi, I'm Crazy Larry MD from Crazy Larry MD's Procedure Emporium, where we're crazy for your health care. We guarantee to charge you only 100% of what your insurance pays after they pay it, or whatever's higher, with approved collateral. Come on down, we'll give you a free ride in my Bugatti. Our internationally sought surgeon will have you for dinner once you pay your bill. Free vasectomy by Rabbi Cutswell with every operation. This week's special, open heart surgery, just $50,000, sutures not included. At Crazy Larry MD's, call for the latest location. I'm crazy for your health care.
The Eugene Environmental Film Festival believes in creating space and a platform to address and bring light to critical issues facing our planet. They support the work being done at local and global levels and share a deep connection and responsibility to protect the environment and work in solidarity with others in the struggle for environmental justice. They do this through creating a 10-day event with meaningful and inspiring films, discussion, speakers, workshops, and special events in downtown Eugene and surrounding areas. They screen all films in person and offer online viewing with closed captions for accessibility. They also strive to provide opportunities to connect participants with outlets to take action on environmental and social justice issues. In addition, they carve out space for young filmmakers 18 years old and younger. The purpose is to highlight youth involvement in concern for and protection of the environment. Eugene is the birthplace of our Children's Trust, which is an organization to empower the voice of youth to protect the environment. If your film is chosen for the film festival, they aim to provide complimentary lodging at a homestay, film festival passes, and access to special events. In addition, filmmakers have an opportunity to discuss their film at screenings and special events. This is a great opportunity for filmmakers to promote their work, inspire change, and network with others. I spoke with filmmaker Lisa Spencer.
So I make films with children. And I have been in New Mexico for the last couple of years, and a lot of the films are environmental because of the cultures there and because of the environmental crisis that we're facing with our water. So Water Star Medicine talks about how the Rio Grande has been running for 400,000 years, and in the last 20, it stopped running consistently through because of just the overconsumption of the water. So I taught middle school students, and we dove into the science of water.
Yeah, it's an arroyo, right, the Rio Grande.
Yes, and we have there's an acequia system in New Mexico. So the acequias, like, they'll run and then they'll shut off. So, like, for example, like, if you have a ranch, you know, you'll have, like, an acequia, you'll have, like, 1 hour on Tuesday from, like, 3 to 4. So the acequias will open, you'll have water, and then it'll close. And we're the only place in the world that has an acequia system. So, but, of course, if the Rio Grande isn't working or running, then there's no more, then all the acequias are dry. So we're in just a huge crisis because we just don't have enough water because of the overconsumption of, because it's the Colorado River. So, of course, Denver and all of the cities are pulling the water, so it's not getting to New Mexico anymore.
Oh, the Rio Grande is fed by the Colorado River. So doesn't it also get rain, seasonal rains?
Yeah.
So to overconsumption of water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then we interviewed a Maori scientist who's a very powerful woman who's traveling all around the world with her book, Water, about water. I don't know the name of the book, but I contacted her because I saw her work, and it's brilliant. And I said, hey, I'm teaching kids how to make a film on water. Can we interview you? And she said, yes. And then she said, we can use any of her footage, and we had her come to our class via Zoom, and she just taught us all about the intelligence, memory, and how we heal ourselves and make ourselves sick with our own water and with our own saliva and with our own thoughts. And I just think it gave my kids a lot of new information about the power of water.
So it sounds like it gives them hope, like because the kids here at the university, they're in despair over the environment. So how old are these kids? You're giving them hope then?
Thank you. Yeah, they are 11 to 13. And actually, we studied Greta Thunberg. We watched her and studied her. We studied a lot of different children. So that's how I started my course. We started studying a lot of different children around the world who have changed the world for the better. And one of those children was Greta. And so I think, you know, it's kind of like any movement. When you see somebody like you, you're like, oh, women can do that? Oh, I'm a child. I can be a leader in the environment. Like, it really gave them a different way to use their voice. I think when we're in despair, it's because we aren't participating in the change. I think when we're participating in the change, we don't feel the despair because we're in the movement. So they don't feel despair. They feel angry and they feel on fire. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Because they're now participating. They've been on the radio and on the TV and on the film festivals, and they're really, you know, bringing their culture forefront.
And so you're empowering these. Can you give me an example, a specific example of a kid that came in one way and went out another?
Yes. I mean, Magnus. That's my favorite. Magnus, who actually played the drop of water in the film, he came in to film. He wanted to be in the film class, and he is from the Yupik tribe. He's Alaskan native and half European, and he never met his family, his native family, because his mother died when he was very young, an infant. And so he came in with ideas about this film that he wanted to make, and he first came in with like a very, very long thick article about climate change and how it's affecting tribes in Alaska. And then he brought in a map, and then he brought over the globe, and he showed me. He's like, this is where my tribe is. He's like, this is where my mother's from. This is where my grandmother's from. This is where I was where I'm from. And it's, you know, I want to make a film about this. And so, you know, when he came into making film, he was bullied. He was shy. He didn't fit in. He was traumatized. He had been in foster care. You know, his mother was, you know, very disempowered because of what's happening tribally in Alaska. And after 2 years of filmmaking, he is incredibly empowered. The first film, when he was making it, his grandma came to me and was like, you know, he can't make the film anymore. He's not sleeping. He's not doing well. And by the time the film was over, he was starting to really find his voice. And then he made another film in eighth grade. So the first film was Quinnahawk. It showed last year here. And he came. And he got to feel incredibly proud of himself and of his people and where he came from. So he kept that theme. And this year he made another film called 35,567 You Pick Stories. And he interviewed the famous band Pamuya. And, you know, some people would say, well, that has nothing to do with the environment per se. Like, what, you know, what was the topic of that film? But Native people don't really separate environment from anything else. It's like part of spirituality. It's part of identity. So it's all in there, you know. And it's in the lyrics. It's in the dance. It's in the style of the way they, you know, use the dance movements. It's in the way they, their language, you know, like however many words for the word snow, you know, I mean, it's in everything that they do. And so, I would say that the children maybe felt like, and because they're not being represented, you know, they're not being represented in legislation. They're not being represented in culture. They're being told what their rights are, they're being told where their voice is, they're being silenced, and nobody really has a lot of value for who they are or what they have to say or how they feel. And I was telling these folks earlier that they're on the bottom, New Mexico's on the bottom for children's rights, they're on the bottom for education, you know, and so these children are just the least of the priority of anyone. And so all of a sudden, there's this new platform, and it's filmmaking, and it's storytelling. And now all of a sudden, they're on the top because nobody, they don't have to ask permission for their voice. They're being given a platform. So you can definitely feel a difference. And I do feel like these are our leaders, you know, because we it doesn't matter how conscious we are or how good we are or how much we try, we're just never going to be at the same place as someone who's more connected to their spirituality than they are to the material world, because they haven't been inundated into consumerism the same way that we have as adults. And so they're always going to be ahead of us, you know? So it's incredible to see them when that light bulb goes on. They're like, oh, wait a minute. You know, like they've been on the radio. I was telling these folks, they were on AMC, All Black, All Native. They've been on all of these different platforms talking about the environment and the water and respect and asking, you know, people to give them more attention. So my PhD was in social justice. I got into film work totally on accident. I am a musician, so I think it started there, but I work in legislation and the children know what I do. And I was telling these folks, I was at a quinceañera and they're all these students that I've known throughout the last couple of years are running up to me and they're like, did you change the child marriage laws? You know, is child pornography still legal in 6 ways with 6 exemptions in New Mexico? You know, can we make more movies? You know, what's going on with the Rio Grande? Has there been any sort of new legislation around water usage? I mean, no adult is coming up to me and asking me if the 6 exceptions for child pornography have been, you know, if now there's more exceptions. You know, like I said earlier, the kids, they don't bullshit. And they're exhausted. You know, people have been making excuses their entire lives, you know. Like it's all hands on deck, you know. So
right, and so they set an example to other students. Magnus, other students have joined the the cause. And,
yeah, absolutely. And a lot of the cultural barriers start dissolving. I mean, being in New Mexico, it's very multicultural. So it's incredible to see different ages, different races, different socioeconomic backgrounds, different religions, all working together. It's like they don't even have those same divides.
Are we going to see some politicians come out of this?
I hope so.
It's really important to get into them early, to get this going early.
It is, and I think there's also a really big shift. I was telling these folks that, you know, during the Relocation Acts and the genocide of Native people, New Mexico was part of Mexico, and a lot of that area was Mexico. So the same history is different, is not, right? It's a different history. So a lot of, like, the pueblos, the 13 pueblos of Santa Fe and the Taos Pueblo and all these pueblos in northern New Mexico are intact. They've been there for tens of thousands of years. So what's happening in New Mexico, not just the children, but also there's a real anti-colonial movement, and there is a reclaiming of not the environment as something that's outside of us. Like, water is not outside of us. You know, our earth is not outside of us. You know, and maybe it is for European people, maybe it is for American people, but for Native people, and as an observation, it is their identity. And I think as that is being reclaimed and as that is being empowered in the communities, with the women, in the ceremonies, the way plant medicine is legalized, the way children are still, you know, celebrating their cultures and their pueblos, like, it's shifting. It's like we're shifting back to a better place because of this. And you're right, when children are being kept in their culture and being empowered and their voices are being empowered and they're really coming into this their voices and saying, you know, I'm not separate from the water. I'm Maori scientist who's famous and beautiful and gorgeous told me so. I mean, what are you going to say? As far as on the hard side of things, it's the 50th out of 50 as far as education. It's the lowest. As far as child protection, I mean, some of the laws that I'm working on, I mean, I've never seen anything. It's disgusting. I don't know if you've seen, like, maps of, like, parts of the world where, like, I don't know. I mean, this stuff is so heavy. But the United States is in a really bad place ethically, and the way we treat our children is disgusting. I mean, you know, we've always raped children. We've always raped the land. We've always, you know, this is, like, who we are.
But we're neglecting their education. The real crime is
what I think. Well, neglecting their sexual safety is the real crime. I think it just keeps going and going and going. But as the children are standing up and going, we don't want to be raped anymore. We want our river. Our education should be a priority. You know, like, they're coming in strong. Like, they're pissed. And a lot of the children also have watched, like, they're generationally, you know, things being taken and taken and taken. My boss at my last university I worked at did a TV show on HBO, a film, and one of the interviews that was done on a reservation in Arizona, they were talking about how all of the reservations are being rented from the U.S. government. And we're watching this, and I was showing the children some of these clips, and they're like, I don't understand. Like, they stole our land. And now we have to rent it from them. But there's a whole agenda. The United States government, even until the 1970s, wanted to dissolve all Native reservations. So there's an agenda. They want the reservations to fall. And they want so many people to move off the reservations so that they can reclaim that land and exploit it. And they want that to happen because what happens when people hold their language and hold their culture and hold their integrity and hold who they are as a people is that they go against the agenda of the United States government. Right? So that's why what we saw in Oregon last year at this film festival, where all these people right here in Oregon are being arrested and kicked off their own land because they want to be, because the European people want to mine it and make money. And the government wants to do it. So, you know, you can talk about New Mexico all day long, but Oregon's just as bad as anywhere else. We're all part of the problem unless we're part of the solution, right?
You said their future, you know, the reason they're pissed, though, is all they have is corporate. They're going to end up working for a multinational corporation as a flipping burgers or a clerk in some minute. That's the future they see. So, you know, Dylan said, "When you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose." So, they have the most to gain and a lot to lose if they don't make these changes.
Yeah, I think I agree with a lot of that. But also, you know,
they can see what's going to happen to them in the future is what I'm getting at.
But I think that yes and yes, but also I think they have more potential than any other group that I've seen in this country because they come from something. They come from integrity. They have sovereignty. They have their own passports. They're not a part of, when this country goes down, they're not a part of that. They didn't make that happen. They were the ones that were trying to save it. They were the ones that were trying to preserve the water. They were the ones that pray for the water. They're the ones that go into, you know, vision quests and longhouses and peyote meetings. And they're the ones that have been protecting the land since the beginning. They're not the ones who destroyed the buffalo population. They're not the ones who destroyed the water and the sky and the land. They have nothing. They have nothing on their belt. You know, that's not their story or their karma. They're going to be fine. They know how to live in the desert without water. It's the people who don't know how to, you know, like I was telling about the hurricane, it's the people that don't know how to live on the land for 3 days without going crazy. They're the ones that have something to worry about. I'm not worried about these people, frankly. I'm worried about the people that are not protecting them.
Well, and that's just it. They're going to destroy that, make it to where they can't do that. That if we take over all the land, the corporations are making it to where, like with glyphosate, with Monsanto and stuff like that, if I can't grow organically or even live out on the trail, you know, off the land anymore, they're going to take it over to where that you are forced into slavery. In other words, you're forced to work for a corporation in order to live. You cannot live subsistence farming and subsistence living.
Mm-hmm.
And, will be a thing of the past.
And remember that quote, like during Nazi Germany, when they were like, "Oh, first it was the Jews, and then it was the handicapped people, and then it was the people that were like homosexual, and then it was the people who were gypsies, and then it was the women."
Then they came
that
for me. It's enclosure. They kept fencing off the land.
Mm-hmm.
And the king, you used to be able to go into the king's forest. You know, Robin Hood. You could hunt deer in the king's forest. Now, and then they put fences around it, and you can't do that anymore.
Right. I feel like this entire country just needs to say, okay, Monsanto and people that want to destroy the earth and people that want to do these kinds of things, they can just have, like, they can have their own state or something. But yeah, we are buying into it every single day. You know, we're participating in it. We're paying taxes on it. They're putting us in a position where it's just hard enough to even be in this country that we don't even have the energy to fight for too much. And it's very dangerous. And that's what's so great about children. They don't have anything to lose. They're like, this is bullshit, and this has to stop. But they come from somewhere that has taught them to be connected to something much bigger and much more beautiful and something much more powerful. So I do feel like there is a great hope for. I think this is the best young generation ever.
They know there's another way.
They know there's another way. They're tired of bullshit. They say it how they feel. They're articulate. They want to learn, and like even the apathy that is here is because they are so in tune with how problematic our culture is.
I spoke with Cafe Mom team member Brad Partner.
Right, so Cafe Mom is a local Eugene organization?
It is, yes.
You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, we've been in business almost 35 years. Been working directly with co-ops this whole time. We import directly from Chiapas, Mexico. Only work with co-ops, so we're 100% organic, 100% fair trade. Long-standing relationships with all of our growers. They're our partners. They're our friends. I don't know.
Well, so they call it a co-op, and I'm going to ask. I should ask her this too, but. The co-op is everybody gets a vote. Does Cafe Mom get to participate in the voting and decision making a little bit?
Not of the individual co-ops. They are autonomous to themselves. There are five co-ops that we buy from. No, they all do their own thing, including who they sell to. And we're fortunate to have cultivated these relationships with them.
All right, and I noticed they're not in Fred Meyer. How do we get them in Fred Meyer? And I don't think we want them in Walmart, do we?
That's a challenge. As a small company, us working with the large entities, that's a real challenge. We're in six locations of Albertson Safeways, and so even that has been a challenge, but at least we're able to get in here local stores that are in both Eugene and Portland and Corvallis. So just support local small businesses right down through their coffee shop level and look at what people are serving. Just be conscious consumers. You vote with your dollars.
You know, they said that the producers have to, they need money immediately, so sometimes they'll take a deal from the international producers, like Nestle and them.
Right.
Is there any way that...
The Coyotes.
Yeah, the Coyotes. Yeah. Is there any way Cafe Mom would create a microbank? Could you guys create some kind of microbank and make loans?
What we do currently is, as soon as we sign contracts in the fall, which is before the harvest starts, we do like 60% pre-financed so that the money is already in Chiapas to be able to, for the co-ops to be able to put pre-financing out there to the growers before the coffee's even harvested.
All right, so you're addressing that.
We are currently doing that to the best of our ability. It's not always possible, honestly, but the last several years we've been meeting that 60% mark of pre-financing.
Right, and it takes support from us consumers is how that where that money comes from.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's set up as a cooperative.
But I mean, the reason there was a book by E.F. Schumacher called Small is Beautiful. It's about how capitalism is if people mattered, and what it was is, and that's why they kept small, no one over 500 people in the organization. So that, I mean, that's why they have these small entities, is that everyone has a vote in the community. It supports, the whole community decides what's going on.
Totally, yeah. And it's, you know, the size of the farms is limited. It is all a cooperative of small farmers. So,
but so that it can be controlled by the people that it serves.
Correct, yeah. I mean, the structure is that the co-ops, all the delegates elect leadership that then makes decisions, but it's all also done. There are meetings in each municipality very regularly to send the delegates to meet at the central meetings that make the decision. So it is a form of, I mean, not every member is present at every meeting. I mean, certainly at the annual meetings, but it is a representative forum where people get together and make decisions.
But I mean, that's why it benefits the community so much, and why
it
affects the health and welfare of the people of the community, and they grow other crops. And I assume he didn't mention they probably do medical. It ends up paying.
There's all sorts. Right. There's all sorts of things that are community-based projects that are done to help the local communities, building schools, building meeting places. Communal coffee drying patios and doing the wet milling processing up in the mountains. That's all. Those are all examples of infrastructure per se that the co-op does together to share with each other.
But it's a bottom up decision making process.
Absolutely.
For all
yes.
That. And,
yes. So yeah, including how they spend the proceeds and. The decisions are made about those projects together. It is all done collectively, yes.
I noticed they're talking about Africa and the Caribbean and all that are involved in the small producers.
Correct,
union.
Yeah.
So in the WTO in Cancun, a Korean guy committed suicide because of our farm subsidies.
Right.
So does Nestle and them advocate for... Do corporations advocate for farm subsidies that affects the price?
There's a lot of manipulation that goes on to affect the price. In coffee specifically, you know, there's basically eight large family conglomerates that control 90% of the trade. So they actually have the ability to, and this has happened in previous years, buy up all the crop from one country, essentially, or buy up as much as they possibly can, get it all exported, get it on ships, and drive the price up artificially before it hits the ports, because they basically are like, well, we've got to pay what you're going to pay for us to even land this coffee, because we're rich enough basically that we can hold on to it and dump it if we don't get the price that we need.
So they corner the market and then keep the profits. The profits don't go to the growers or the
producers. Oh, no, not at all. Not at all.
It's the middleman that ends up with that.
Well, it's the large entities. I mean, it's the large corporations that end up with it. The coyotes are just pawns in that larger play. And it's all about buying green coffee at the early stage to then manipulate the price down the road a little bit, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Someday, though, do you suppose they would be independent and not dependent on exports? I mean, that wouldn't work for Cafe Mom, I know, but I mean...
Well, there's always going to be exports of, I would say coffee, because, I mean... the game of where the consumption is done versus where it's all grown. I mean, it really is in a belt right around the equator, and there is a lot. There's going to have to be some sort of exportation because of all the folks in the global north that are consuming it.
Well, the flavor comes from the area that it's grown in, but it also comes from the way they're saying where they don't have a monocrop. That adds to the flavor.
Absolutely.
Other fruit trees and stuff.
Absolutely. And it's part of the what has made Chiapas specifically such an incredible source. It's within Mexico, it's the best coffee growing region. It really is. And it's funny because I'll just say some people look down their nose on Mexican coffee and say it's inferior, but it's the climate in Chiapas.
It's a tropical paradise.
Exactly. It's perfect for growing great coffee.
Okay, so you're getting the flavor from a tropical paradise.
Correct. Yeah.
I spoke with Princess Bass Mason. She recently graduated from the University of Oregon with a BA in political science. She's passionate about language revitalization and evolution and hopes to contribute to tribal language programs and indigenous sovereignty. She's an intermediate beginner Western Shoshone Newe Takwa speaker and plans to begin Klamath and Modoc language lessons in the fall of 2024. She plans to go into the field of law. She produced the film Kla-Mo-Ya Languages.
So can you give me an example of how learning language taught you about culture? Or and the question you asked him, too, about land stewardship, how it links to land stewardship.
So one example of how the language connects to culture is that in the Nuwadegwap and Western Shoshone, there's not really gendered language. There's more of a... when you're referring to a person that may be female or male, you just say that one or that one over there. So it kind of changes the way you think about people a little bit. And also the way of going about certain things kind of shifts a little bit. In my mind, when I'm speaking Nuwadegwap, I'm not really... I'm kind of taking myself away from the context of English or like the westernized world, I guess. You have to kind of be in a different frame of thought. Like it's kind of like a shift sideways. I don't really know how to explain that. I wish I had more immediate examples, but... and then how language and land stewardship is connected is that, at least for when I was learning Western Shoshone, there was just different... I just feel you feel more rooted in different natural objects. Like there's different words for trees, and then the species of the trees, the different words and like phrases that regards the seasons. It just makes you a lot more involved in like rooted in that place of being, I guess.
So it's part of a system, not just something, not a commodity.
The
plants and trees.
Like all of it's interconnected. Like maybe the root word for a tree is, but the word for leaf is like sugi, and so sometimes small word like that is connected to the word tree. Stuff like that. So it, like you said, it's kind of like interconnected. There's like offshoots, and it's really cool because it also connects you not just to the land, but also to the different people that reside on those portions of land. So like. you might use a certain phrase or word, but then your neighboring tribe will use a different, like a slightly different phrasing, and then you can kind of like communicate and like be like, oh, why do you call it that? And then, I don't know, it's just really interesting. So it makes you more involved with that place that you are at, and then also with other people around that, because it always starts a conversation on like, oh, why does your tribe call it that? This is why our tribe calls it that.
Well, you started to say that it puts you in a different, it shows you the difference between Western culture and indigenous culture. Can you think of an example? What Western culture commodifies everything is for one thing, and what else do we do differently? What about time? Things take more, you'd slow things down.
An example of that is just when you're actually speaking Western Shoshone. So like right now I can, if I'm nervous or something, I'll talk a little bit faster, or that's just the natural way I speak. But for Western Shoshone, you want to elongate your vowels, like your vowels, and just take time, because a lot of time there's like repeating O's, for example, or like, let me see. Ne princess me naniha ne nanamuna. So like you can't just like go through that word really fast. Nanam, like no one's gonna know what you're speaking of. Well, we'll know because everyone's kind of learning it, but the traditional way of doing it is to take the proper amount of time to get that word out. So I like that's kind of an example of you know, the different timing. Like in English, you could pretty much understand people saying things kind of faster and squished together. But when you're doing it with Western Shoshone, especially when you're first beginning, you want to take it all the way down to the ground level, the fundamentals, and keep building from there and make sure that you're timing things slowly. You're not in a rush to say anything.
It forces you to appreciate.
Oh, yeah. No, it's about appreciating it. And it's just like, in Western Shoshone, for example, you don't have like a higher tone when you're asking a question. You might even lower your tone of voice when you're asking, like
inflection.
The inflection. So it's like, it's just different ways of like pronouncing and asking things. Like another thing is in Western Shoshone, you don't really need like to do the inflection because you have a particle that indicates that you're asking a question.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
All right, thanks. Keep up your good work. What's the impact? Why do we need this, though? Why is this so important that we learn these languages? What will happen if we lose these languages in this culture?
I mean, that'd be a sad day. I don't believe we're ever going to lose languages because people are continuously doing the hard work of, doing research in the universities, looking at all of those stuff that was heading away from Native American people and other indigenous peoples. But there's also language keepers and knowledge keepers around. So, I mean, I don't even want to consider like, oh, it's never going to exist. But sometimes that is the reality for some Native American people or other indigenous people currently. So, I mean, it really profoundly affects those people that have that part of their identity taken away from them internally or externally.
But, I mean, Western culture has something to learn from that. Would lose something, too. I mean,
Western culture would, but I'm not really concerned about what the Western culture would lose. It's not really about, oh, what can we do for the Western culture? It's more of like, I want to look internally and what is this doing for my people now and what has it continually done like throughout history?
I mean, I guess I mean the world, not Western culture.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's really sad when everything is homogenized. It definitely takes away from all the lives we're leading, whether or not we're invested in those cultures.
Right, homogeneity. We don't want everything to be the same.
It's boring, it's forced, it's a yawn, I don't know.
All right, thank you.
Thanks.
For more information on the Eugene Environmental Film Festival, go to eugeneenvironmentalfilmfestival.org.
Friends of Family Farmers advances programs and policies that protect, promote, and sustain resilient and economically viable community agricultural systems in Oregon. Their formal members encompass about 10,000 acres of grazing land in our state. According to Alice Morrison, co-director of policy and development of Friends of Family Farmers, holistic management, adaptive management systems, multi-paddock grazing, amp grazing, all of these kinds of grazing have become part of the regenerative livestock movement in the last several decades, are tied to indigenous practices and natural systems that have existed for thousands of years. Friends of Family Farmers is an advocacy organization trying to push
our state government into a position where they're supporting this type of agriculture at least as much as they are supporting conventional systems. Oregon has the potential to rise up and create not only really vibrant ecosystems, but also really vibrant local food economies. Bringing those two things together is something they do through their Oregon Pasture Network. There's a reason that we have the dominant agriculture system that we have in this country. The federal government has been investing in that type of agriculture as well as the infrastructure surrounding it. The slaughter and processing system in our country determines what kind of agriculture we are allowed to have. If you have to have your meat processed in a certain plant inspected by a certain government agency in order to legally sell that meat to the public, that plant has the ability to determine which farms thrive and which farms do not. There are economic disincentives for those plants to work with small independent producers in the current system. Right now, according to Morrison, four companies control more than half of the chicken processing capacity in the states: Tyson, JBS, Purdue, and Sanderson. 70% of the pork processing capacity is controlled by four companies: Smithfield, JBS, Tyson, and Hormel. And 75% of the beef processing capacity is controlled by four companies in the U.S.: JBS, Tyson, Carville, and National Beef. More than half, in some cases three quarters, of the ability to bring a product to market is controlled by very few companies. The way that these contracts function is that they also determine your feed sources and how you're allowed to raise your animals. You're entering into a contract for the practices that you're using and the system that they're creating for the uniformity of their product. If you choose not to be part of that vertically integrated system, to farm in a regenerative manner, or be an independent producer, your options for legally bringing a product to market are much smaller. Oregon has something called the State Need Inspection Program. Right now, most of the processing capacity in this state is USDA federally inspected. There are only 13 facilities in this entire state for all of the farms that you raise animals. That means that there's very little capacity for new farmers and small farmers. 12 to 18 month wait times to bring their product or their animals in to be processed in order to sell that product means they're making their appointments before their animals are even born in many cases. Those facilities have a disincentive to work with small farms producing for a certain type of customer who wants to know exactly how their animal was raised. Because of the amount of traceability and labor that is required to work with a small producer, corporate facilities have to change out their processing capacity and labeling. This creates a disincentive to work with a small producer over someone who's bringing them truckloads on a regular basis, which is what the contract system creates. The State Meat Inspection Program represents an alternative to the USDA inspection system. Friends of Family Farms worked with legislators to get this program authorized in 2020, because if we lose only one processing facility, there could be a risk of what the USDA calls depopulation. It's what you think it is. I spoke with Alice Morrison at this year's Eugene Environmental Film Festival. You can slaughter your own meat, but even the neighborhood butcher can't sell meat that hasn't been inspected.
Well, you're more worried about the larger processing and the small processing. It's just that, you know, how there's demand side and supply side. So
yeah.
If people saw their meat being butchered in front of them, which they don't even see that anymore.
Yeah. And I think that is really important to like make sure that people are making the connection between where the food is coming from and how it gets from the field to your fork. And I think that the thing that makes it a little bit different with this type of inspection is that this is not a retail inspection.
Right.
These inspectors have to be present for any action to happen, and they have to be present the entire time. So it's a different level of inspection that has to happen, because many retail facilities are inspected on a like twice a year basis. They do spot checks, but with this type of position that we're trying to fill, those folks literally have to be present for any slaughter to happen. So that is really the bottleneck in the USDA system, is that those positions are not funded well enough, they're not attractive because they're not paid very well, and it's created a real lack of capacity in people being able to like turn on their machines and operate at a way that would make them profitable, which for a slaughter facility that requires so much safety equipment, so much expensive specialized equipment, and so much like cold storage and food safety handling, those margins are very small. So we want to make sure that we're, you know, honoring the work of the farmers and also providing
a way for the capacity that the state has worked so hard to build to not fall on its face in the final hour.
But are they more restrictive to you than they are to the corporate, to Cargill and Hormel and that?
I would say that all of the processing standards are the same. There is a USDA standard that the state inspection program does have to meet. It's the same safety standards. It's just that we have more of control over like how many people and who does it and all of those things. But so the reason that it's harder for a smaller producer to access that is truly economies of scale. Like that is really what we're talking about here, because if I am bringing you 10 head of cattle at a time and I'm only bringing them to you like at three times throughout the year, I am not considered like a bulk customer, and then it takes much more of their staff capacity to make sure that like this exact carcass is my carcass versus the capacity of the whole day.
They're inspecting it by lot.
Exactly.
And so right. Now they have more lots to inspect.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, and so there is that economy.
They need more staff.
Yes, and yeah.
And so that's the issue that you're trying to change with the legislation, is get funding for this staff that is needed.
Yeah, and so really what happened here is that the governor's budget only allowed for a 1% increase in continuing service level funding for all state agencies this year, or the governor's agency requested budgets, which turn into governor requested budget, which goes to the legislature for approval. But the governor made a mandate that agencies could only ask for 1% increases. Because these are new positions and ODA is a fee-based agency and doesn't receive very much general funds, there was no room for any new positions at ODA. They are only doing technical upgrades because they only have about $500,000 of increase they're allowed to ask for last biennium's budget to this biennium's budget. So they're not putting any new positions into continuing service level. And so that meant that even though these facilities that they've invested in are just now coming online and it's been a very slow process, they were not able to close the loop and ask for the positions that they need now to bring it to the next stage.
Right, so these are high-paying jobs, though, so these would
yeah,
be
these
really
are
good
career,
jobs.
Career jobs,
but how
yes.
does it affect the price of meat? I mean, we may have to pay a little bit more for sustainably sourced meat.
So this state program has no fees to participate. It's just a legal requirement that you have to have the inspector there, but the facilities don't pay for the inspector. So that it doesn't have an increase in the supply chain costs. It's just a legal requirement for food safety.
Well, so our tax dollars pay for these inspectors, which
yes.
there's nothing, whatever, they can stop doing something else that we don't want to pay for it,
mm-hmm.
so, or whatever.
Yeah. Food safety is very important in the meat sector,
there
especially.
There wouldn't necessarily be an increase in taxes just
right.
to fund this.
No, we don't anticipate that that's true. We've spoken to the agency and to legislators who have a very good look at the fiscal outlook for the next biennium, and we think this fits into general funds just fine.
Please check out OregonPastorNetwork.org and FriendsOfFamilyFarmers.org if you would like to find a farmer who aligns with your values you'd like to support. For KPW News, I'm Curtis Blankenship.